Welcome back, everyone, to the next installment of the QSI virtual seminar. I don't think we have a name for it, but let's just call it QSI virtual seminar series. Our next speaker is Adrian Chapman from the University of Sydney, and he's going to be talking about free fermion solvable spin models. Take it away, Adrian. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, and thanks everyone for the opportunity to speak today and talk about a little about what some exciting research that I think is going on at University of Sydney. So today I'm going to be talking about free fermion solvable spin models and their characterization via graph invariance. This is work that I've done in collaboration with Stephen Flamia at the University of Sydney, and you can find our paper on either Quantum or the archive here. And this is a big graph. So okay, let's see. Okay, great. So our motivation is, well, we care about finding exact solutions to things. You may care about this because, well, for one thing, it actually teaches you something interesting. You may want to, say, design new topological quantum materials, possibly for error correction. And you may just, you know, want to know about some interesting quantum properties that many body systems exhibit. So we are going to be thinking about exact solutions for spin models. And one particular very interesting family of solutions is what are called mappings to free fermions. So these are sort of mathematically elegant mappings that you can use as the starting point for perturbation theory or sort of an effective theory to describe a much more complicated system. And they also have a really rich and interesting connection to complexity theory. So for one thing, they are sort of simulated by match gate circuits, which are the most general time-dependent free fermion Hamiltonian circuit class. And so these were, you know, examined in these early references, but it's sort of an ongoing, this is an ongoing field of research. They also have an interesting connection to what's called the FKT algorithm, the Fisher-Castle and Temperley algorithm for calculating weighted perfect matchings of a planar graph. And they've also recently been shown to have a connection to what's called the sensitivity conjecture. So there's recently a paper connecting the proof of the sensitivity conjecture to a mapping from an adjacency matrix to free fermions. So it'd be, you know, there's an interesting sort of connection to computer science that you wouldn't have expected there. And in all of these applications, graph theory plays a central role. So as I mentioned, some connections to graphs with the FKT algorithm, but there's also connections to graphs with the sensitivity conjecture and in match gate circuits. So these are sort of the family of exact solutions of spin models that we're going to be looking at. Before I talk about what fermions are, I'm going to talk a little bit about graphs. So sort of the central object of this research is these graphs, which are defined in terms of Hamiltonians. So if you don't know what a graph is, then a graph is just a set of vertices together with a set of what are called edges, which are just pairs of distinct vertices. I won't take self-loops of graphs in this case. And to just give kind of an example, I'm going to consider a Hamiltonian, which is defined on, in this case, 4 qubits. So it's the XY chain with a local Z field pointed on every qubit for 4 qubits. And I'm going to define a graph from this Hamiltonian by assigning a vertex to every term in the Hamiltonian written in the Pauli basis. So I'm gonna call this the frustration graph. And so I'm gonna call the frustration graph of this Hamiltonian is one whose vertices are the Pauli terms written in that basis. And the vertices in the graph are neighboring if and only if the corresponding Paulis in the graph, in the Hamiltonian anti-commute with each other. So the frustration graph of this Hamiltonian is an 8-vertex graph, and you can see the vertices labeled. And so you can see that if vertices correspond to anti-commuting Paulis, they're neighboring. And so this graph has some sort of resemblance to the spatial structure of the Hamiltonian I started with, but it's not exactly the same. So this is kind of a way of capturing the spatial structure of the Hamiltonian together with the algebraic relationships between the different terms. So this is an example of a graph, and this thing called the frustration graph is the central object that we're going to be looking at. So just to like maybe motivate this a little bit more, I want to consider what I call a discrete dynamical system. So given a graph, we're going to assume that, think about this graph as corresponding to some Hamiltonian, and I want to sort of iteratively compute its Lie closure. So what does that mean? I want to take nested commutators of terms in the Hamiltonian until I can't make anything new. But I'm going to define this dynamical process in terms of the graph only. So given the graph, I iterate through all the edges of the graph. And so for every edge in the graph, here's a highlighted edge between vertices V1 and V2E, I'm going to add a vertex whose neighbors are vertices neighboring exactly one of either V1 or V2. So I'm going to take the symmetric difference between the neighborhoods of V1 and V2, and I'm going to add a vertex which neighbors only vertices in the symmetric difference. And so this corresponds to Lie closure, because if I think of V1 and V2 as anti-commuting terms, then their product has neighbors which are in the symmetric, which are the symmetric difference of the neighborhoods of V1 and V2. And then I'm also going to stipulate that I can't add a vertex if there's already a vertex with the same neighbors. So if I happen to take this iterative update again, then and I add a vertex with the same neighbors as a previous vertex that I've already seen, I'm not going to allow that. And so I'm just going to repeat this discrete dynamical process until the graph saturates and the process terminates. So let's just, as a numerical sort of experiment, look at how this process behaves on two different models. So one model, the model on the left, is the model we've just seen, which is I will call solvable. And this is the graph of this model. And the other is what I'm going to call not solvable. And I'm going to add just one extra term to this model, corresponding to one extra vertex in the graph. And that's the sort of integrability breaking term. So I'm going to run this process on each of these graphs, and we're going to see what happens. So just to start with the solvable model, hopefully everybody can see the animation playing. So we see that, it gets kind of big, but it saturates quickly after about 28 vertices. And that's what we would expect a little bit, because we know that this model has a sort of bounded size of its Lie algebra. But for the not solvable case, when I iterate it, well, it grows quickly, and it grows actually much larger and faster than the original solvable case, and it saturates at 63 vertices, which for those curious is 2 to the 7 minus 1, I think. Maybe it's 2 to the 6 minus 1. But anyway, so somehow, even though I only had one extra vertex in this not solvable Hamiltonian, this iterative update procedure, which was defined only in terms of the graph alone, somehow knew that this process would iterate to something much bigger than the original graph without that vertex added. So somehow these graphs intrinsically know whether or not they describe fermion Hamiltonians or solvable Hamiltonians or not. And so that's kind of starting point for thinking about these graphs as sort of like important structures to describe Hamiltonians. So now I'm going to talk about what it means for a Hamiltonian to be a free fermion Hamiltonian. So let's consider the solvable example. And what we need to do, or the sort of conventional solution to solve this model, is to apply what's called the Jordan-Wigner transformation. And so what we do is we define Majorana modes. We define for n qubits, 2n Majorana modes, defined in terms of Pauli operators. And these Pauli operators are non-local. So they have for the 2j, for the, say, jth pair of Majorana modes, gamma 2j minus 1, gamma 2j, I have Pauli's occupying spin J or site J, and these Pauli's have Pauli X or Y at the site of interest, and then in our convention, a string of Pauli Z's extending all the way to the left. So these are not, this is a non-local mapping, and you can verify, maybe it's just easy to see, that these Majorana modes satisfy what are called the canonical anti-commutation relations. And so these modes all mutually anti-commute with each other, unless they're identical, in which case they square to the identity. And so that's what this 2 delta mu nu i is capturing. So when we perform this transformation on the Hamiltonian terms, the terms in this Hamiltonian above, we see that they give expressions in terms of Majorana operators, which are quadratic. So just as an example, if you look at gamma 10 times gamma 11, and you multiply their corresponding Pauli operators, then you'll find that they multiply up to a phase to just a, even though both of them are non-local, this, these strings of Z's cancel everywhere. And you end up with a local term, which is just one of the terms in the Hamiltonian, in the original Hamiltonian. So this will happen for every term in the Hamiltonian. So once you do this, you get a Hamiltonian described in terms of Majorana fermions, which is quadratic. And therefore, you can write it as a bilinear form acting on a vector of operators, these gamma operators, which is, so this bold gamma is a vector of gamma operators. And so since all of these Majorana modes anti-commute with each other, without loss of generality, I can take the coefficient matrix H to be a anti-symmetric one. And it also must be real because of the Hamiltonian is Hermitian. And we can also take it to be traceless because if I just ignore the trace, that's just a constant energy shift on the Hamiltonian. So under quadratic Hamiltonians, the Majorana operators themselves transform covariantly. So if I take my Majorana operator expressed originally in terms of its Pauli definition and conjugate it in the spin picture by the integral Hamiltonian, then this just maps the Majorana operator to a linear combination of Majorana operators whose amplitudes are given by the exponentials of the single particle Hamiltonian or the coefficient matrix H here up to some factor. And so that greatly simplifies the calculation of anything you want to compute about this Hamiltonian, because basically it means that its conjugation action on the observables in the Hilbert space is reducible. So this single particle transition matrix, this thing called e to the minus 4h, is a member of the orthogonal group. Say 2n by 2n matrix because it's generated by an anti-symmetric matrix. And so as I said, we can easily find, we can easily exactly solve this Hamiltonian, by which I mean find the spectrum and its eigenvectors by diagonalizing H itself. So explicitly what we do is we find a generating Hamiltonian for an orthogonal matrix, which diagonalizes H. So because H is anti-symmetric, we can only block diagonalize it. We can't directly diagonalize it. Via orthogonal matrices. So it block diagonalizes into this direct sum of 2 by 2 blocks with these anti-symmetric Williamson eigenvalues. When we embed later this diagonalizing orthogonal matrix, e to the 4w or e to the minus 4w, into the spin picture, these are c's, but they should be gammas. The conjugation action on H actually just diagonalizes it completely to a linear combination of Z operators. So there are no sort of correlations in its eigenvalues. All of its eigenvalues are sums and differences of single particle eigenvalues, which were the Williamson eigenvalues of the original anti-symmetric Hamiltonian, single particle Hamiltonian. So we recover all 2 to the n eigenvalues of the original Hamiltonian by taking 2 to the n sums and differences of n single particle energies. So the Hamiltonian energies have a compressed description, and in fact, you can also find a compressed description of its eigenvectors as well. And so this is what it means to solve a Hamiltonian by free fermions, is I can get all of its eigenvalues and eigenstates by simply reducing the problem to one which is exponentially smaller, and then diagonalizing a matrix on that smaller space. So let's look at another free fermion solution aside from the 1D model I described. So this one's a little bit different. This is the Gataev-Honeycomb model. And the Gataev-Honeycomb model is a quantum compass model, which means that it's defined on a lattice, and the interaction definition depends on the direction of the bonds of the lattice. So you'll see that on this picture of the honeycomb lattice that I've drawn, there are 3 bond colors, blue, red, and green, and each of those corresponds to a different interaction type. So spins joined by blue bonds interact by XX operator interaction, and green is ZZ, and red is YY. And so these are the only interactions. So everything only interacts by everything only sees its neighbors by one of these three interaction types, depending on which direction the neighbor is. And so this has an extensive set of commuting symmetries, this model does. And these are bonds on cycles of the lattice. So if I multiply these yellow bonds, I don't know how easy that is to see, but around cycles, then I'll get operators that commute with the entire Hamiltonian and in fact every term in the Hamiltonian. So they sort of commute universally with this Hamiltonian. So if I have an Lx by Ly lattice, where Lx and Ly are the linear dimensions of the lattice, the remaining effective Hilbert space after I restrict to a symmetry sector of all of the Plaquette and if it's on a torus, you can also have non-trivial homological loops winding around the handles of the torus. If I restrict to the mutual eigenspace of all of these things, I retain Lx, Ly qubits. So I retain an extensive number of sort of effective qubits even after restricting to a fixed symmetry sector. So this extensive set of commuting symmetries is not enough to completely solve this Hamiltonian. And so one of the great insights of Kataev when solving this model is to notice that what is left over once you've done this restriction onto a fixed eigenspace of the symmetries is that the remaining Hamiltonian can be mapped onto a free fermion model. And so this free fermion Hamiltonian is what we do to complete the solution. So this free fermion mapping happens locally, unlike the Jordan Vigner transformation. And what we do is we map each spin, so X, Y, or Z, to four fermions, where to two of four fermions, where each spin sees a fixed sort of shared mode between every spin at that site, and also its own sort of unique fermion. So say sigma X is going to have is going to be mapped to BX times C, and when we do this, we actually enlarge the Hilbert space at each spin. And so there is a resultant new symmetry at each vertex, which is the product of all four Majorana modes of that vertex. And that simply enforces the constraint that the product of three Paulis gives me the identity. X times Y times Z gives me the identity. And so when we express the Hamiltonian this way, we find that these bond fermions, these B alphas, pair up and give you operators which commute, again, universally with the Hamiltonian. So they are new sort of symmetries that you get from this embedding as well. And so we can restrict the Hamiltonian to a fixed symmetry sector of its plaquettes or its cycles by restricting to a fixed symmetry sector of these bonds. So these bonds carry the information of which symmetry sector on the plaquette symmetries we're restricting to. And once you've restricted these bond degrees of freedom to plus or minus one, the resulting Hamiltonian that is left over is now quadratic in just the matter fermions or the C operators. And that just gives you a free fermion Hamiltonian, which you can then again solve. And so you have to go sort of iteratively solving the Hamiltonian sector by sector. Before I proceed, just want to give a brief outline of the talk to come. So I've divided the talk up into three sections, which I sort of classify in terms of three graphical structures. So the first section of the talk is about cliques. The second section is about cycles, which I associate to stabilizers. And the third is going to be about independent sets and sort of their physical relevance. And just to briefly mention what each of these graphical structures is. So here's a graph. It's this this big graph on the right here. And so, but before I say that, so cliques and cycles are what this paper is about, and independent sets are going to capture some ongoing work that is happening at the University of Sydney. So cliques, if you're unfamiliar, are subsets of vertices or subgraphs that are complete. So a clique is a graph where every vertex is neighboring to every other vertex. And so you can see a clique is highlighted here in this larger graph. A cycle is maybe what you expect or what we know from the previous solution to the Kataev-Honeycomb model. It's just a graph in which every vertex has two neighbors It has this, what we just imagined as a cycle. And an independent set, if you're not familiar with that, it's a little bit hard to see if I just highlight the vertices by themselves, is a set of mutually non-neighboring vertices or the complement to a clique. So these are, if you think about the Hamiltonian as this is the frustration graph of a Hamiltonian, these vertices are sets of mutually commuting operators in the Hamiltonian. The first section that I'm going to talk about involves what I think of as fermions, and so we're going to talk about cliques. So the main question we wanted to address in this work is to ask, when is a mapping to free fermions, either via the Jordan-Vigner transformation, like type honeycomb type solution, or some generalization thereof, when is that possible? So suppose we're given a general Pauli Hamiltonian. What we're asking is, when can we define distinct quadratic fermion operators such that the commutation relations are respected? That is, when can I find pairs of modes, gamma J sub 1, gamma J sub 2, which I map P sub J, from which I map P sub J, such that Pauli's anti-commute when the Majorana quadratics do. To say this in sort of graph theoretic language from the frustration graph picture, we want to know when can we label the vertices of the frustration graph by subsets, so these gamma subsets, which can overlap with each other, of size at most 2, such that the neighboring vertices on the frustration graph have subsets that intersected exactly one element. So Majorana fermion quadratics anti-commute if they happen to intersected exactly one element, if they said of their intersection, size of the intersection set is 1. And so that's what we're asking for. We want to find pairs such that we can assign pairs to Pauli's and Pauli's anti-commute only if they overlap at one of the elements in the pair. And the answer to this is what are called line graphs. So a line graph is a graph defined from what's called a root graph. So if you're given a graph, which can be anything, a root graph R, its line graph is the graph whose vertices correspond to the edges of R, and two vertices are neighboring in the line graph if the corresponding edges in R share a vertex. So just to give an example, here's just a graph. This is our root graph. And the line graph mapping assigns a vertex to every edge, and vertices are neighboring if the edges are incident in the original graph. And so the line graph of the black graph here is this graph. And you may recognize that as the sort of integrable model that we looked at before, that 4-qubit Hamiltonian. So our fundamental theorem from this paper says that there exists a free fermion description of a Pauli Hamiltonian at the way that I've defined earlier. If and only if its frustration graph is a line graph. So it's a necessary and sufficient condition to determine when a generator-to-generator free fermion solution exists, given a Pauli Hamiltonian. And so why did I say this has something to do with cliques? So another description, an equally equivalent description or equally valid description of a line graph, is a graph for which there exists an edge partition into cliques, such that every vertex belongs to at most 2 cliques. So here in this graph on the right, this thing which is a line graph, the cliques are the triangles. So every vertex belongs to at most 2 triangles. Some vertices belong to exactly 1 triangle, but every vertex belongs to at most 2 triangles. So this is an edge partitioning into cliques. So this is a decomposition of a line graph. So just to give a quick proof sketch of our fundamental theorem. So this is the theorem we want to show, given the Pauli Hamiltonian, when can we find this mapping? So this mapping exists if and only if the graph is a line graph, the frustration graph is a line graph. So if the mapping exists, then clearly the frustration graph is a line graph because the definitions are exactly the same. So definition of a line graph is the condition under which Pauli's anti-commute if they have a free fermion description. If the frustration graph is a line graph, so what we want to do is associate a fermion to each clique in the Krauss decomposition of that line graph. and give each pally the fermions corresponding to its clicks, and that will constitute a valid free fermion description of the Hamiltonian. So I'll say a little bit more about some caveats to this later, but this is all you actually need. So once you have this, there's a very straightforward recipe for computing everything you might want in the same sort of way as either the XY model or the Kataev-Honeycomb model. And so not every graph is a line graph of some graph. So that's an important point. And so I'm just going to give an example, which is called the claw. So before I tell you what the claw is, consider a path graph, P3, which has three edges, and its line graph is the path graph of one edge fewer, P2. So I'm gonna look at the line graph of this path graph on the left. So clearly, or maybe it's not clear, but we can see it, no matter how an edge or edges are added to the interior vertices, we always make a triangle. So no matter how I do this, we always make a triangle. And adding an edge to the end of the path only elongates the path. So it is therefore impossible for a line graph to contain a claw. And so a claw is a graph of, it's a complete bipartite graph where one vertex is neighboring to three mutually non-neighboring vertices. And if you remember, the non-integrable example of the Hamiltonian we saw earlier does contain a claw. So this is the example of the Hamiltonian that when we started that discrete dynamical process saturated to something like 63 vertices. And so we see that it violates our theorem because it contains a claw and so therefore cannot be a line graph of some other graph. So this Hamiltonian does not satisfy the theorem, the criterion of the theorem. So that doesn't mean that it's not integrable in other ways. It just happens to be the case that in this particular model isn't. A kind of more general or formal way of saying this is that there's actually a forbidden subgraph characterization of line graphs. So if I'm given a graph, I know it's a line graph if and only if none of the subsets of its vertices induce one of these 9 forbidden subgraphs. So when I say induce, I mean I look at the collection of its vertices and I consider only those vertices and the edges between them. So no edges to anything external. And so if a graph contains any one of these 9 as an induced subgraph, then it can't be a line graph. And so these 9 anticommutation structures, you could say, obstruct the kind of free fermion solutions that we're looking at. So they just obstruct the line graph property of a frustration graph. Some other sort of curious things about this theorem come from what are called isomorphism theorems. And so, there's the Whitney isomorphism theorem, which says that every line graph has a unique root graph except for one, and it's the triangle. So this complete graph K3 is both the line graph of itself and also of a claw. So maybe it's simple to see that this is that both of these graphs, when I take the line graph, give me back the click K3. That's one kind of interesting isomorphism theorem. Another one is from Young, which says that if two connected graphs are edge isomorphic and have more than 4 vertices, then there is also a vertex isomorphism which induces that edge isomorphism, and that is a unique vertex isomorphism. So if I have two graphs for which I can preserve their edge incidence relationships by permuting the edges, then that permutation is generated or induced by a vertex permutation. And so this is an example of an exception to this theorem and we'll see exactly which edges we need to switch, but you can switch two edges on the root graph, which are not induced by any vertex permutation on the root graph. So these algorithms have been used to give a dynamical algorithm to recognize line graphs in linear time. And there are previously known earlier algorithms which are non-dynamical, but still perform this recognition efficiently. So if you see or if you're given a Pally Hamiltonian and you want to know if there's a generator-to-generator mapping that tells you if it's a free fermion one, it's very easy to just recognize just by looking at it, basically. You can just run it through this line graph algorithm. So one implication of the first theorem that I said is that a single qubit does not have a unique free fermionization, and this is actually the only time that this happens. So if I look at a frustration graph for a single qubit Hamiltonian, it can be fermionized by either giving every spin or every Pally operator a pair of Majoranas that is some subset of size 2 of a set of 3 Majorana modes, or I give everybody a common mode, gamma 3, and then everybody also a unique mode. So in this case, Z gets gamma 1, Y gets gamma naught, and X gets gamma 2. And so this mapping on the right, we call it the even mapping. Since gamma doesn't participate, we sort of have an extra symmetry, which is we call the parity symmetry, and that's the product of all 4 Majorana modes, as we saw with the Kataev-Honeycomb model mapping solution. Right, and then, as I said, line graphs can be recognized efficiently from the isomorphism theorems I said earlier. And then a third implication of these isomorphism theorems is that that if I am given a spin model and I am given a Clifford symmetry which preserves the symmetries of the spin model, so suppose I'm given a Clifford operator that preserves the symmetries of the plaquettes, commutes with all the plaquette operators, then that Clifford is also a symmetry of the single particle Hamiltonian, except when the frustration graph is one of these three line graphs on the right, which is a line graph of one of these three root graphs on the left. So the edges which are labeled, the edges which are labeled on the root graphs and the vertices which are labeled on the line graphs are structures which you can switch, which are not induced by any vertex isomorphism on the root graph. So I can switch this sort of interior edge to this triangle and this dangling edge off the side, and that will preserve the edge incidences. So that will actually preserve the line graph, but there's no vertex permutation that does this. So you can actually find explicit examples of Hamiltonians with Clifford symmetries that are not free fermion themselves, not free fermion symmetries themselves, but you know, they realize these graphs, but nevertheless are symmetries of the Hamiltonian. So that's everything about cliques and fermions. So now I'm going to talk about another sort of important detail about these models, which are called what I call cycle symmetries or cycle stabilizers. As I said, a cycle is this degree 2 closed graph. And so what we're doing when we look for symmetries of the Hamiltonian, one very important set of symmetries that we're interested in are what I'm going to call graphical symmetries. So these are symmetries that I can sort of learn just by looking at the frustration graph of the model. These are naturally products of Hamiltonian terms that commute universally with the Hamiltonian, just like these plaquette operators commute with every single term in the Hamiltonian. These symmetries are graphical structures, and it turns out that for these line graph models, you can only have three different kinds. So the first is twin vertices, the second, as we saw, is cycles, and then the third is the fermionic parity operator, which we saw with the single qubit example. And you need to solve the free fermion model over each mutual eigenspace of the symmetries. Sometimes you will have a model that, when you embed into a free fermion model, actually has, a non-trivial parity operator when the parity operator in the spin picture was trivial. So you have to project down your free fermion solution onto a fixed parity subspace as well. So twin vertices are vertices which have the same neighbors in the anti-compatibility graph. So if they have the same neighbors, then their product commutes with everything in the Hamiltonian, and we can remove them by fixing their products, which are stabilizers. So here's an example of a graph. It's not a line graph. It's actually one of the forbidden subgraphs that I mentioned earlier. And we can notice that it has two twin vertices, which are these labeled vertices in red. And their product, so here's by the way, a labeling that realizes this frustration graph in terms of qubits. And so when I fix the product of these two operators to an eigenvalue, I get a graph. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to say this one of these twin vertices is this stabilizer, which is I'm fixing to a particular eigensector. And then I say it's that thing times the other twin. And when I do that, I can remove that vertex and add its amplitude to the other vertex. And now this is a line graph. So what we see is that it's possible to remove these twin vertices, and you can also use that to remove forbidden subgraphs. And this can only be done for pairs of terms in general, because if I have more than two terms that are maybe linearly dependent multiply to a constraint, I can only replace them by stabilizer equivalences, which don't give me anything less than what I had before. So I can't necessarily remove vertices if I have that. So as I mentioned, it's possible to potentially remove some of these forbidden subgraphs if they contain twins. And in fact, three of these forbidden subgraphs actually contain twin vertices. The claw, this one I just showed, and this is actually a click missing an edge. So this is a K5 graph without one edge. And so they all have pairs of twin vertices, and once we remove them, they're no longer forbidden subgraphs. And so if it turns out that when I wire these forbidden subgraphs into the global graph, the labeled vertices in red remain twins, then these subgraphs can be removed and the Hamiltonian can be solved. And actually, so there's an example of this in the literature, this Liebschultz-Mathis paper, I believe it's the Ising-Heisenberg ferromagnet. So you have to restrict to the twin vertex symmetries in order to realize that this model has a free fermion solution. So the next set of symmetries I want to talk about are cycles and parity symmetries, the other two classes. And so these symmetries are going to show up as elements of the kernel of the adjacency matrix mod 2. So this is what it means to find a subset of Hamiltonian terms that when I take their product commute with everything the Hamiltonian. That's sort of the graph theoretic way of saying that. And what we're going to use is the fact that the adjacency matrix of a line graph factorizes mod 2 into its root graph incidence matrix. So the incidence matrix of a graph is a matrix, it's a binary matrix whose, in my convention, the rows are indexed by edges and the columns are indexed by vertices. And so it's simple to verify that this product gives you the condition for vertices in the line graph to be neighboring if I take this mod 2 product. So using that factorization, and as I said before, graphical symmetries are vectors in the kernel of the adjacency matrix mod 2. So according to that factorization, there's two cases of an element in the kernel of A. So either it's in the kernel of B transpose itself, or under the action of B transpose, the vector is mapped to something in the kernel of B. So the only elements in the kernel of B transpose are subgraphs of subgraphs of the root graph of even degree, which are cycles, or disjoint products of cycles, actually. Vectors which are mapped under B transpose to the kernel of B. So the kernel of B is the all ones vector. And that is what we will call the fermionic parity operator. It's the vector whose which is mapped under B transpose to the all ones vector. So this corresponds to a combinatorial structure called a T-join, which always exists if the number of vertices in the root graph is even. And a T-join is simply a collection of edges such that every vertex has odd degree in this collection of edges. So we naturally sort of associate this to the fermionic parity operator. And then the last sort of detail we need to sweep up in these mappings is the sign of the mapping, the image of the Pauli under the free fermion mapping. So the only thing that I required was that the Paulis have the correct commutation relations with each other, but I'm still free to exchange the indices in the image of a Pauli. So I'm still free to exchange gamma J1, gamma J2, and this just gives me a sign. And so how do I know that I faithfully reproduced the properties of the Hamiltonian if I don't fix that sign? So you can also think about this sign as an orientation on the root graph, because like I can just imagine a fiducial orientation and just ask, like I give a fiducial ordering to the vertices and I just ask, you know, how does the ordering of my operator or the sign of my operator compare to the fiducial one? So it turns out that we actually fix this orientation already. Sorry, we choose this orientation already when we fix the cycle symmetry eigenvalues. So what we need to do is we first need to choose a spanning tree of the root graph. So this is just a set of edges, a subset of the edges of the root graph, which contains no cycles. And we are free to orient the edges on this tree arbitrarily because all orientations on this tree are sort of their anti-symmetric single particle Hamiltonians are orthogonally equivalent. So no matter how I orient the edges on this tree, I can always think about that as a sign redefinition on the individual Majorana modes themselves. So it's just a single particle change of basis. And so this can't change the spectrum of H, but it does change the eigenvectors of H by that single particle change of basis. And it's simply a sign or a handedness convention when you choose the orientation of the edges of this tree. So then the only thing you're really able to do is fix the edges not in the spanning tree. And so what we need to do is choose the orientation of the edges not in this tree according to the sign of the independent cycle. So like we fix the symmetries in the cycles and each of these cycles corresponds to one edge not in the spanning tree, or each of the independent cycles does. And whatever the eigenvalue of that cycle operator that we're fixing, we just choose that orientation to correspond to that eigenvalue. And so this guarantees that no matter how I multiply Pauli terms around cycles in my original spin model, the corresponding multiplication of free fermion terms is going to give me the same sign. Okay, so to put all that together, if you're given a general Pauli Hamiltonian, you first check if its anti-compatibility or frustration graph is a line graph, possibly by removing twin symmetries. If it's a line graph, you can find the graphical symmetries and restrict to a fixed eigenspace. For each symmetry eigenvalue configuration, you have to choose an orientation of the corresponding free fermion Hamiltonian, and then you can just solve it. And occasionally, or you know, if the Pauli picture parity operator, if multiplying the Paulis to give you a parity operator actually gives you something which is trivial or equivalent to the cycle symmetries, then you have to restrict onto a fixed parity eigenspace in your free fermion picture to remove that extra symmetry from this embedding. And so maybe it's just helpful to look at some examples. So here's the generalization on aperiodic boundary conditions, or like closed boundary conditions of the model I showed earlier. So this is the most general nearest neighbor 1D model. And so this is its frustration graph. It's colored according to its clique decomposition. So every color is a clique in the Krauss decomposition. And then when I take the root graph, or I realize that this is the line graph of a graph whose vertices correspond to these cliques. And so the vertices in the root graph are correspondingly colored. The red edges are a highlighted spanning tree. So notice that any edge that I add off of this tree creates a cycle. And it turns out that in this model on closed boundary conditions, the products of the Pauli operators around a cycle always gives you the identity. So you have to fix the symmetries according to that. So if the symmetry only has one eigenvalue, namely one, if it's just the identity, then you have to fix the edges not on the spanning tree according to that sign. Okay, and so we can revisit the Kataev-Honeycomb model. So the Kataev-Honeycomb model, if you remember its Hamiltonian, all three terms, the terms correspond to edges of the interaction graph on a honeycomb lattice, and all three terms around a vertex on the honeycomb lattice anti-commute. And so the frustration graph of this model is actually the Kagome lattice with the click decomposition shown like this, colored black and blue. And this actually turns out to be the line graph of the honeycomb lattice again. So you can map the honeycomb model from a spin model back onto a set of free fermions hopping on a honeycomb lattice, which corresponds to, people think of this as graphene. And so actually what's happening when you pick conserved bond operators is you're actually choosing an orientation of the spanning tree and an orientation of the edges not on the spanning tree as the eigenvalues of the bond operators. And strictly speaking, you have more freedom than you need because only the edges not on the spanning tree are what matter, and the rest of them are sort of orthogonally equivalent. So there are other examples where this has applications to error correction. So this is something called the 3D gauge frustrated hex honeycomb gauge color code. I don't know if honeycomb is actually in there, but so this was introduced at QEC in 2019. So this is a generalization or a modified version of the gauge color code where we sum over the hexagonal faces, the cubic cells, and the ball cells. So on all of these cells, there are both X and Z type stabilizers. And you can actually, you know, so all X and Z type stabilizers acting on the same body commute with each other because they all these operators have even many vertices on them. So each of these vertices is a qubit. And you can realize that the faces of this model actually anti-commute according to an array of 1D chains, which are actually disconnected. So the blue hexagons, you can see they all touch at exactly one vertex to their neighbors. And when they cross the other sort of hexagonal chains going orthogonally, they touch them at two or even many sites. And so if you alternate X, Z, X, Z, then you see that they anti-commute along a path. And that's actually the frustration graph of just of a path, which is a line graph. So this set of Hamiltonian terms is a free fermionic solution as well. So you can also make up new models using this characterization. So this is one that we came up with called the Sierpinski-Hanoi model. And it consists of triangular three qubit terms, X, Y, Z, on the filled cells of a Sierpinski triangle. Its frustration graph is a graph called the Hanoi graph, which quantifies the allowed towers of Hanoi transitions. So states of this, vertices on this graph are states of the towers of Hanoi problem, and they're neighboring if there's an allowed transition between the two of them. Surprisingly, this graph is also a line graph, and it's actually the line graph of a subdivision of a Hanoi graph of size one smaller. So there are also some gauge qubits in this model, and so we found that the model encodes logical qubits at a constant asymptotic rate of 11 over 18. So that's a constant number of gauge qubits encoded in this model. You can also add a local field to the model without breaking its solvability. And when you calculate the spectrum according to the single particle energies given by the free fermion spectrum, you see that there is an excited state degeneracy, which actually approaches zero as you increase the size of the system. And so we conjecture that this is actually related to the scale symmetry of the model when you take the infinite limit. So That's sort of the main results of the paper. This gives you a way to characterize free fermion solutions to spin models. And so now in the last couple remaining minutes that I have, I'm going to talk about some ongoing work that is happening at the University of Sydney, which corresponds to the independent sets of frustration graphs. In this work, we want to answer the question of whether there are free fermion models for which there is no hopping graph. So these are mappings sort of beyond generator to generator mappings. And what I say, what I mean when I say there's no hopping graph is I mean that even though there's no generator to generator mapping, there's still a unitary which maps the Hamiltonian to a sum of single particle, a sum of single site Z operators. So it's diagonal in that sense. It's sort of single particle diagonal in that sense, single particle energies lambda J. And so it turns out, yes, there is such a model, or there's at least one model that gives an example. And this is a model introduced by Paul Fenley in 2019. And so this is the ZZX or four fermion model. It has ZZX terms on adjacent sites on a 1D chain. And its frustration graph looks like this. And this is not a line graph because this highlighted set of edges is forbidden. And you can just extend this this graph as long as you want. Nevertheless, this Hamiltonian, for all values of its coupling coefficients H sub J, has a expression in terms of this this sort of single particle diagonalization. And so how do these kinds of mappings work? Well, that's what this work is meant to sort of figure out. And so if you think about the previous set of mappings as sort of being linear, they sort of map generators to generators, I would sort of intuitively think of this set of mappings as corresponding to polynomials. So what do I mean by that? The way to construct these mappings is to construct a set of charges from the independent sets of the graph. So I'm going to take all the independent sets of the graph of a fixed size, call it K, and I'm going to construct a conserved charge for each K given by the sum over all such independent sets of the products of all Hamiltonian terms in the set. So this product is a product of commuting Hamiltonian terms, and then I sum over all the commuting Hamiltonian terms, all the independent sets. Keep in mind that the independent sets themselves, these products, may not commute with each other within the sum. So our first lemma that we derived is that if the graph itself is claw-free, so line graphs are claw-free, but they are not all claw-free graphs. If the graph is claw-free, then these charges that you define commute with each other. So and also with the Hamiltonian. So as I said in this parentheses here, I define Q0 to be the identity just sort of naturally. And then Q1 you can see is just the Hamiltonian itself. And if the graph is claw-free, then all the charges commute with the Hamiltonian or with each other. And as a special case, they commute with the Hamiltonian. So they're conserved and commute with each other. So then what you do is construct a transfer matrix, which is a polynomial, an operator valued polynomial whose coefficients are powers of U and also multiplied with a charge Q sub K. And furthermore, if the graph is not only claw-free, but also what's called even hole-free, then you have this relationship. So the transfer matrix multiplies with itself on minus U to give you a number. So this number is proportional to the identity of this thing on the right, and it's in fact the independence polynomial of the graph. So if you have a claw-free, even hole-free graph, then this transfer matrix multiplies this way. And so these relationships, these two lemmas are extremely important for the mapping. In claw-free graphs, just to kind of give a sense of how these lemmas are proved, the symmetric difference between any two independent sets in a claw-free graph is always a bipartite degree two graph, which is also a disjoint union of paths and even holes. So for example, consider two independent sets of the graph that I showed, the four fermion model. The blue vertices are one independent set, none of the blue vertices neighbor each other. The red vertices are another independent set, which none of them neighbor each other. And together their symmetric difference, which is everything, induces in the original graph just a path. And this is actually a general property of symmetric differences of independent sets in Clawfrey graphs. So because they're bipartite, this implies that if I take two products over independent sets and try to commute them past each other, they anti-commute only if the number of edges in this induced graph is odd. So then we can use this to show that in those two lemmas, the terms that you might otherwise get that you don't want always cancel to just give you what you want. So you know, it's a bit hand wavy, but that's what we do. And so claw freeness and even hole freeness are sort of necessary conditions for that. So here are the two lemmas again. The graph is claw free, then the charges you define this way are commuting. And if it's even hole free, then the products are multiplied to an independence polynomial. And the theorem that we conjecture is that if the frustration graph is both even hole and claw free, then it has a free fermion solution. So this is satisfied by this four fermion model introduced by Fenley. And by free fermion solution, we mean something of this form. And these U sub J's are these zeros of the independence polynomial, or the square roots of the zeros of the independence polynomial. So that's our theorem. And so using the two lemmas, or the analog of the two lemmas for this particular model, Fenley shows that the transfer matrix that you find factorizes this way. So it factorizes the product of operators which are diagonal on the Z basis for single spins. And if you just compare the linear terms, you get the desired result, that the H itself, which is the first order term of T, has a diagonalization in terms of just single particle energies. So going back to our original sort of table of forbidden subgraphs, we see that even though all these forbidden subgraphs can prohibit generator-degenerator mappings to free fermions, all of them actually themselves have free spectra if they're not wired into any larger graph. So so the top row has twins, so it is a, if it's not a line graph or even whole claw free, then you can remove the twins to give an even whole claw free graph, or sorry, to give a free fermion solution. And then everything in this green box is even whole and claw free. And so it satisfies our conjecture theorem. And indeed, you can numerically check that any Hamiltonian satisfying these commutation relations has a free fermion spectrum given by exactly what you expect. And so maybe the main takeaway from this talk is it's not just the fact that things anti-commute, it's actually how they anti-commute that's important. And it's that specific sort of relationship that tells you interesting properties like this. So that's the entire talk. What we did is we gave a graph theoretic characterization. We've shown how graph theory can sort of elegantly capture the nuance of a wide class of free fermion solvable models. As I said, the beyond generator-to-generator work is ongoing. So that's an open, there are some open problems related to that still. Other things we want to do is we want to see if it's possible to add to this translation invariance to get even more refined characterization. And then another question is, do local unitary rotations give you something else as well? So if I try to find local unitary rotations and restrict myself to that, can I remove the forbidden subgraphs either of a line graph or the even whole claw free characterization? And so as I mentioned before, the beyond generator to generator mappings is ongoing work with Sam Elman at the University of Sydney and also with Steve Flamia, and the translation invariant free fermion work is ongoing with Alicia Kalar. And then the local unitary rotation work is ongoing with Dennis Stegemann. And so finally, some just more open-ended applications that we envision is, I call this an open question of, is there a general trade-off between connectedness and fermionic entanglement? So sort of what we're sort of seeing from this this work is that as you make the frustration graph of the Hamiltonian more connected, of course there's details to this, but you generally sort of see that the Hamiltonian gets closer to a free fermion one. Line graphs are extremely connected because they have this click decomposition, And even whole cloth regraphs are also quite connected. So it kind of makes you wonder if this is indicative of a more general phenomenon relating sort of the frustration connectedness to the closeness to a free fermion model. And so different sort of ideas we've had to investigate this have been to look at quantum impurity models, which are models with a bounded number of non-fermionizable terms, fitting to the closest free fermion model by an effective theory, or by decomposing a non-free fermion Hamiltonian into a subset of terms, which are individually free fermion, but maybe commute in arbitrary ways. And sort of that subset tells you something about the what we call the free fermionic rank of a Hamiltonian. So those are sort of some outlooks of the work. And if you're interested, you can look at the paper either on the archive or on Quantum. Thanks very much.
Very good. Thank you very much, Adrian. Are there any questions from the audience? Just unmute yourself and blurt out your interruption and then ask your question. Adrian, you mentioned that I don't remember the wording, but you were talking about a single qubit and how there was some, like it was unique in some way. And I think there are many similar results about like how dimension two is somehow special. Mm-hmm. And we don't really have a good kind of intuitive reason for why that is. Do you get any sort of intuition for why dimension two seems to be special here?
I'll tell you what my intuition is. So my intuition is that at small dimension, there's not a whole lot that can happen. And so all kinds of things start sort of like falling on top of each other. It's sort of my intuitive explanation for why the qubit has a non-unique free fermionization. So that free fermionization is sort of, you can think about it as, I guess, sort of different representations of, you can think about it as being sort of analogous to an accidental isomorphism between groups. So fermions generate special orthogonal groups, and of course, qubit spins generate, or spin Hamiltonians generate unitary groups. So there are lots of accidental Lie algebra isomorphisms at small dimension. So I haven't actually said what this graph is, this big one that I keep showing all over the place. So this graph is the line graph of a complete graph on six vertices, but it is also the frustration graph of the most general two-qubit Hamiltonian you can write down. So what that says is actually that the general two-qubit Hamiltonian has a free fermion description in terms of six fermions. And that's sort of equivalent also to an accidental isomorphism between SU4 and SO or spin 6. So that's sort of my intuition for why, is that at small dimension, there's lots of accidental sort of like equivalences that happen because there's just not enough room for anything interesting, like, you know, for things to sort of diversify.
Right. Okay. About this graph, did you draw that by hand or did some software choose that arrangement?
So this is a combination of Mathematica, Inkscape, and some adjustments I made by hand.
I see. Because I'm looking at it, and it looks like there's like some asymmetries that's just kind of because the... It should be kind of symmetric, right?
Yeah, it is kind of symmetric. So it's what's called a strongly regular graph, I believe. So it has the property, it has graph theory symmetry, which, you know, you can't really look at it and see if it has symmetry, but, right. It's regular. So every vertex is the same degree. Every pair of neighboring vertices has the same number of common neighbors. So like, yeah, two neighboring vertices all have, say, like lambda neighbors. I think that's the right parameter that people use. And then also every pair of non-neighboring vertices has the same number of common neighbors. So it has that kind of symmetry. And it turns out that these graphs are very highly symmetric. And if I just want to calculate the spectra of the adjacency matrices of these graphs, it turns out that that spectrum is not only highly degenerate, but only depends on those parameters. So there can be many non-isomorphic, strongly regular graphs, but their spectrum only depends on the number of, on the regularity, the degree of every vertex, the number of common neighbors to every pair of neighboring vertices, and the number of common neighbors to every pair of non-neighboring vertices. So only those three numbers determine the spectrum. So yeah, this is actually a very symmetric graph.
Right. Do we have any other questions for Adrian? Okay, well, if not, thanks for the talk, Adrian. And thanks for the timing. It was perfect. And you got your reference in there. So I guess if anyone wants to learn more, head over to Quantum. And otherwise, we'll see you around Sydney.
Sure. Thanks. Great. Thanks very much.